My guest is James Trefill. He's Clarence Robbins Professor of Physics at the George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia, and a founding member of the Society for Scientific Exploration. He's also a writer. Winner of the AAAS Westinghouse Award for Science Writing, he has been a regular contributor to Smithsonian and Science Digest magazines. James Trefill has also written several books. His first book, A Scientist at the Seashore, turned a walk along the beach into an eloquent explanation of our hydrosphere. Meditations at 10,000 Feet, used a hike in the mountains to illustrate the principles of earth science. His new book, Meditations at Sunset, published by Charles Scribner's Sons, continues our guided tour of the universe by directing our gaze overhead and addressing some of the mysteries of the atmosphere. He is joining us from the NPR studios in Chicago. James Trefill, welcome to Fresh Air.
Well, thank you, Lee. I'm very happy to be here.
It's a pleasure to be able to talk to you. I feel a little bit like I'm talking to Mr. Wizard, and I'm 6 years old.
Well, I hope it doesn't turn out that way.
No. You make a very interesting analogy at the very beginning of your book, Meditations at Sunset. You draw an analogy between the study of physics and a spider's web. Could you explain that for us?
Well, yeah. The most beautiful thing about physics, and we can talk later if you like about why I use the word beautiful to describe physics.
Why don't Why don't you tell us right now, why do you use beautiful to describe physics?
Well, physics is a science that's devoted to the study of the way things happen in the world. And it's a very beautiful science because at its heart, it's very simple. Basically, everything that happens, everything you can see, you look at the sky, you look at the mountains, you look at the beach, you look at atoms, everything can be explained by perhaps a dozen basic laws. And the discovery of these laws has been the main goal of physics ever since Isaac Newton. And so if you have many, many kinds of phenomenon and only a few laws, that means that all the phenomenon in some way have to be connected to each other. And so when I use this analogy of the spider web, I think of the outside of the spider web as the things we actually see, and the very center of the spider web as the laws that govern what we see. And so you can start into this web at any point. And if you trace your way back, you find you eventually come to one of these basic laws. And of course, on the way, you have many things converging. So things that you might not think are connected, in fact, are connected. For example, the white water you see in a mountain stream and the population of grasshoppers in a field are governed basically by the same kinds of equations. And it's these kind of unexpected connections that to me, make the science beautiful.
Simply, how are they connected?
Basically, they're both what are called chaotic systems. They're systems where the equations are such that there are rapid changes in the systems with time. So that in the same way that white water, the little bits of water, come apart very quickly in basically an unpredictable way, populations of insects do the same thing. They go up and down. They crash and they explode in a way that's basically unpredictable.
It sounds so simple. Why do you think we're all so intimidated by physics?
Well, I've spent a lot of time teaching physics for people who are not scientists. And I think that the basic, what makes it beautiful also makes it intimidating. That is, there's a level of abstraction involved. And in physics, that abstraction is expressed in mathematics. And many people are afraid of mathematics. And this is something they pick up, I suppose, in grade school. And I found that, if you're very gentle about introducing the notion of an equation and wrap it in a lot of words, you can very often get people to see that it's really not so frightening as it appears at first glance. It's just a sort of a shorthand way of writing things down, a different language. But I think that the reason that people, for example, any time you go to a party and people ask you what you do and you say, I'm a physicist, I can guarantee you the population, the conversation just stops dead in its tracks.
Your whole body of work and the work that you're doing is an attempt to try and explain these laws of nature to us. I wonder if it's a reaction against the way that you were taught, or perhaps a way to emulate someone who taught you.
No, I think I see it as a need. The ideas are beautiful. It's as if you had a beautiful melody or a beautiful painting, and you want to show it to people. And that's the way I feel about this. These are things that to me, the structure of physics, these basic laws, discovering the order that underlies the seemingly chaotic universe, is a very beautiful thing. It's one of the greatest achievements of the Western mind, and it's something that people should know about. They should appreciate.
It reminds me of a poem, actually, the way you've chosen natural things to explain, you know, these laws. Mm. There's a poem, "But I see the earth in a grain of sand and nature through a flower. I hold infinity in the palm of my hand and eternity in an hour."
Yes. In fact, yeah, it's that, exactly that sort of feeling. And the feeling that what scientists do is really not so different from what poets do, that has brought me to writing and explaining science to people who perhaps might be afraid to go into it on their own.
All right, here comes the $64,000 question, right. Professor Trefel. Why is the sky blue?
Oh, well, yeah, that's, of course, one of the questions I address in Meditations at Sunset. And basically, the sky is blue because the atmosphere around the Earth is made out of atoms. And atoms are very small things, and very small objects scatter light. And they scatter blue light more efficiently than they scatter any other color light. Mm. Now, the light that comes into the atmosphere from the outside, from the sun, is white. That is, it contains all colors. But as soon as it gets into the atmosphere, the blue light starts to scatter out of it. Think of shining a flashlight down through the atmosphere, and pretty soon the blue light will start to scatter out. And so when you look away from the sun, you're seeing light that went into the atmosphere and then scattered to come to your eye. And, of course, that light is most likely to be blue. So that's why the sky is blue.
Is it the same reason that babies' eyes are blue when they're born?
Yeah, it's basically the same thing. When babies are born, they don't have there's no pigment in their eye, and so what you see is light that goes into the eye and scatters off a little grains of material in the iris, and comes back out. So, and that again, it scatters blue more efficiently than it scatters any other color, and so that's what you see when you look at the baby's eye.
I was interested to find out, when my children were born, that babies first perceive the colors red and yellow. Certain doctors and people mm-hmm. who write books say you should put mm-hmm. red objects and yellow objects. Is this because the eye isn't fully developed yet, and that's the sort of light that is coming into the eye at that time?
Well, of course, the light that goes into a baby's eye is the same as the light that goes into yours. Now, why? I'd never heard that, as a matter of fact, so I don't have an explanation for it. In fact, I always put blue things around my baby's cribs.
Oh, we must read different books then.
Yeah, I think so.
Or as my pediatrician says, I've never yet met a baby who's read the book, right?
Right.
Talking about the sky being blue, now into the staying up in the sky, you're looking at a sunset. And as the sun gradually sinks below the horizon, it appears to change color. But you're saying now that the sun doesn't really change color. It's the way that we're looking at it.
Well, yeah, it's the fact that as it gets near the horizon, it has to go through more air. And the more air it has to go through, of course, the more light is scattered out. And so first the blue light's scattered out, and then the green is scattered out. And finally, when it's coming, just grazing across the surface of the Earth at sunset, everything but the red is scattered out. And so that's what you see. I mean, the color of the sun at sunset is red, and that has nothing to do with the sun. It's just strictly a question of how the light is getting to us.
My guest is Professor James Trefel. His book, Meditations at Sunset, it is about a scientist who is looking at the sky. There's an effect that you describe in your book. It's called the New Jersey staircase effect.
Right.
What is the New Jersey staircase effect?
Well, this came out of an incident that happened. I assume the air in New Jersey is much cleaner now, of course, than it was then. But at this time, I was at a conference in New York and was looking out over the New Jersey shore at sunset and over that area that has all the chemical refineries. And obviously what had happened is that there were just layers and layers of all kinds of different hydrocarbons in the atmosphere, and it was a very still day. There was no wind, so they were just stacked up there. And when the sun went behind that, each layer bent the light from the sun in a slightly different way, and the effect was that the sun grew corners. It was actually like a stairway, a curved stairway going up to the top, and each of the steps in this stairway was a different color. It was a very striking sort of thing. I've never seen it before or since.
I had seen something like that on the train when I was going through New Jersey. As the sun is setting, it's at the bottom, right? Not say at the top where it curves, but more at the bottom.
It can be either way. It depends on how these layers of gunk are in the air. if you'll forgive me for using a technical term,
gunk.
Yeah.
I think gunk is perfectly acceptable. Yeah. There has been some news in lately that everyone is paying attention to. It's the recent crash of the Northwest Airlines Flight 255.
Yes.
They're now reporting that human error, it seems, is responsible for this, that the flaps were in the wrong position. But before that, there was a lot of discussion about wind shear, which is a sudden change of wind direction. How does that affect a plane, whether when it's either taking off or landing?
Well, it affects it in several ways. The most important is that the way an airplane stays in the air is that the wing has one side that's curved and one side that's flat. That's a reasonable way to think of a wing. So the air that's going over the top of the wing has to travel farther and therefore faster than the air that goes under the wing. And the result of this is that there's a pressure on the bottom of the wing, a pressure upward, because the pressure on the top of the wing is lower. And that's called lift. I mean, and that's what keeps an airplane flying is the fact that the air has to do that, and so the air pressure is pushing it up. Now, when you get wind shear, what happens is that for some reason, and there are many ways that wind shear can happen, but the flow of air over the wing changes suddenly, and that can affect the lift. Now, if you're way up in the air, it doesn't matter so much because the plane drops a little, picks up speed, and things go back to normal. But at takeoff and landing, when there's not a lot of room to maneuver, that can be very dangerous. And it's very difficult for pilots to deal with it in those situations.
There's a chapter in the book that discusses the crash of the Delta Airlines jet as it approached Dallas-Fort Worth Airport back in 1985. Yeah. And this was caused by a microburst. This is something...
That's what people think, yeah.
Yeah. What is a microburst?
Well, that's a very good question. A lot of people would like to know the answer to it. Apparently, what a microburst is that somewhere way up in the atmosphere, a big blob of air gets cooled, perhaps by rain falling through it and evaporating. Nobody really understands where they come from. And of course, because it's cold, it's heavy, and it sinks down toward the ground. And when it hits the ground, it sort of explodes and goes out in ripples. So you have a situation where this cold blob of air hits the ground and runs outward in all directions, a little bit like what your water does when you turn it on in the kitchen sink. You know, it hits the sink and then splays out in all directions. So a plane coming into that is first suddenly finds itself in a headwind, which the pilot can adjust for. That changes the lift. And then all of a sudden, very quickly, it finds itself in tailwind. And so the lift in the plane changes very suddenly in that situation. And it's a very difficult situation for a pilot to handle because the change is sudden and unpredictable. And if it happens when the plane is near the ground.
The government apparently is speeding up some research now on a radar. They're said it's going to use, Doppler technology?
Yeah, basically... You see, normal radar works by looking at the density. And the density of this falling blob of air isn't very different from the density of the air around it. So it's basically invisible to normal radar. So what people want to use is something like what policemen use in speed traps, is to not to say what the density of the air is, but how fast the air is moving, so they can detect these falling blobs. That's an experimental program that's going on at this time.
Yeah,
to try to develop that kind of system. So you've got a couple of minutes to identify it, you know, say that it's dangerous and get the airplanes away from it.
It's not something that the pilots could see, perhaps, by...
Absolutely not. No, absolutely not. It's invisible to the eye, and it's invisible to normal radar as well.
You're going to be getting on a plane pretty soon?
I'm getting on a plane, yes, in a few days. And I've just gotten off a plane yesterday.
Knowing what you do about all of this, do you get nervous when you fly?
Well, Dr. Theodore Fujita, who's at the University of Chicago and is the expert on microbursts, tells me that if you last the first 20 seconds, you're okay. So that gives you some leeway.
That's hopeful. My husband believes that actually planes are kept aloft by everybody collectively thinking, you know, keeping this plane.
Well, perhaps that has some role in it.
I think we're moving beyond the realm of physics.
It sounds like it.
At this point. My guest is James Trefill. He is the Clarence Robbins Professor of Physics at George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia. And he has written several books which try to explain some of the mysteries of nature in terms that we all can understand. We're going to be talking a bit more with Professor James Trefill after we take a short break. I'm Leanne Hansen, and this is Fresh Air. My guest is physicist James Trefill. He has written several books on the subject of physics. His first book, A Scientist at the Seashore, deals with the physics of waves, tides, winds, and sands. Meditations at 10,000 feet reveal some of the mysteries of rocks, mountains, and twisted trees, which he observed during an alpine hike. And his third and new book in this Natural Philosopher series is entitled Meditations at Sunset, and it offers some fresh insights into the nature of the sky. The book was published in June by Charles Scribner's and Sons. Professor Trefill, I was wondering if it's possible now for you to look at a cloud and see something like a duck or a a person's face.
Oh, sure.
Face. Yeah?
Sure, of course. One of the things that I enjoy most about the thinking about nature as a physicist is that it doesn't take anything away from my ability to sit down with my kids and see the camels in the sky. But it gives me an extra dimension that I can point things out to them, perhaps that they wouldn't have noticed by themselves.
Well, what do you tell your kids you do for a living when you come home at night? And
oh, that's a very difficult question. Usually, they know I work at a university, and until they're older, that's probably all I need to tell them. They know I have an office somewhere, and I go to it.
What did you do today, Daddy? And you start to talk about electron movement, and
that's right. No, that's a little beyond them still.
You discuss some very rare phenomena in your book. One of them is ball lightning.
Mm-hmm.
And although it's very rare, you've actually seen it.
Yeah, actually, I saw it while I was writing the book. It was kind of a frightening experience, actually. I was driving in northern Wyoming, coming out of the Bighorn Mountains, and there was a thunderstorm. And I was driving through this sort of sagebrush prairie, absolutely desolate, and this double bolt of lightning hit, one on each side of the car, as I was driving by. And on one of them, on one side, I saw this as a ball about the size of a basketball, an orange glowing ball that sort of just sat there for about 3 or 4 seconds and then evaporated slowly. And that is the phenomenon that's known as ball lightning, that this ball of kind of crackly stuff. And it's not something that people normally see. I never expected to see it in my life, but I did that one day.
Now, your description sounds like it might easily be mistaken for an unidentified flying object.
Well, if it was in the air, they usually are close to the ground, and they usually follow lightning strokes. So I've never heard. They're reported as all kinds of things, and there are folk tales about ball lightning, that it does all sorts of things, runs up the legs of stools, and runs out of windows and along telephone lines. And I have no reason to doubt any of that. But it's all, it's not something you can study because we don't really understand what it is.
Hmm. Why do you think that scientists sort of accept that ball lightning exists, even though very few people see it, and sort of dismiss the whole idea of like strange sightings in the sky, strange phenomena?
Well, ball lightning is one end of a continuous sort of a continuous line of electrical things. There's lightning, which everybody's seen. There's St. Elmo's fire, which is something that's been seen enough that, and it's pretty well understood.
Describe that just for a minute, though.
Well, St. Elmo's fire is kind of a greenish glow. It used to be seen a lot on sailing ships. It's basically static electricity that builds up during a storm and then kind of sits around church steeples, anything that sticks up in the air, trees, masts of ships, and it sort of flickers and glows, and it has kind of a cool green color. It's something like a fluorescent light.
Mm-hmm.
And sailors used to think that it was St. Elmo was the patron saint of sailors, and they used to think that if they saw the St. Elmo's fire, then the saint was there, and it made them feel safer. And so it was usually recorded in the ship's logs when something like this happened.
So we've got go ahead.
In Magellan's voyage around the world, the sailors wanted to go back at one point, and they saw St. Elmo's fire, and they figured, well, they were still safe, and so they kept going. So it has some historical significance.
Good thing. So we've got regular lightning, and we've got St. Elmo's fire, and then this ball lightning.
Ball lightning is sort of another thing in that same general category, although it's much rarer. I think probably what triggered scientific acceptance of ball lightning more than anything else was during the Second World War, a lot of scientists suddenly found themselves out in places like Los Alamos in the middle of the desert and started looking around, instead of being in cities. And a lot of them started seeing things like this. And so it became more accepted to wonder what they were, what is this thing and how does it work and why does it show up and why does it behave the way it does?
My guest is physicist James Trefill. Do you think now we're moving into an area that in physics that cannot really be explained by apples and keys on kites and, you know, baseball trajectories and things like that?
Well, I'm afraid that's true. This started really with the beginning of this century with the development of what we call quantum mechanics. When you get down and start looking at things in a very small scale, at looking at atoms, looking inside of atoms, looking inside the nuclei of atoms, the things that exist in there aren't like things we're used to. And what this means, it doesn't mean that they can't be explained. It means that they can't be pictured. And I cannot draw you a picture of an electron. I can draw you a picture of a baseball. But when I talk about an electron or an atom, I can't draw you a picture of what it's like. And this bothers people a lot. And it bothers me, too. You get used to it after a while. But I'm afraid that a lot of the direction that science is going is in this direction of things that are not picturable.
Hmm.
That tells you more about the human mind, incidentally, than it tells you about nature.
Well, I'm wondering if because of that, there aren't certain physicists who are kind of coming up with bizarre explanations.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there has always been... let me put it this way. Whenever you encounter something that's out of the ordinary, there are going to be people who come up with these kind of strange things that want to link it to extrasensory perception or want to say the electrons really have a consciousness. There are all these sorts of things floating around. There's no reason to think any of this. I mean, we can, you know, you have a transistor radio. The satellite we're using uses solid-state electronics, all of which is built according to the principles of quantum mechanics and behaves in a perfectly predictable way. The problem is that if you go away from saying, you know, I want to build something or I want to predict how an experiment will turn out, and go to the question of what's really happening, whereby really happening you mean draw me a picture of it, then I can't do that, and no physicist can. And this sort of leaves an opening for people who perhaps are not as scrupulous about the evidence as they might be.
Hmm. I'm interested by the use of the word philosopher in you call this a natural philosopher series.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever been buttonholed at a cocktail party and someone say, what is reality?
Oh, God, have I ever. Yeah, that's one I prefer to dodge. But you're going to make me answer it, huh?
No, you don't have to actually tell me what is reality, but it's the whole idea of you as becoming you're almost a philosopher now.
Well, yeah. Of course, you know that the term scientist is a fairly new one. I think it began in the early 1800s, and before that, everybody who did what we now call science was called a natural philosopher. It was regarded as just a branch of philosophy, which was the study of knowledge. But it's pretty hard when you start dealing with the very small, the ultimate building blocks of the universe, the things that we're made out of, the Earth is made out of, the galaxy is made out of. It's pretty hard to avoid getting philosophical or seeing the philosophical implications in what you're doing.
Hmm. Is there any research that's being done now that is of particular interest to you?
You mean in general? Well, actually, I'm working on the problem of who killed the dinosaurs or what killed the dinosaurs.
Really?
The problem of... mass extinctions in the history of life on Earth. This is a very interesting field because we now believe that at least some of these mass extinctions, like the one that killed the dinosaurs, were caused by the impact of asteroids or comets on the Earth. So it's a sort of a brand new field, and people are coming into it with all different kinds of backgrounds, and we're all having to learn each other's specialties. For example, this summer, which I spend my summers in Red Lodge, Montana, and I spent some time out collecting fossils with a group from the University of Michigan, which was was a new and very interesting experience for me.
Hmm. Well, have you discovered anything? Anything that you might be able to tell us about?
No, I think that this is a field that's very new, and in my opinion, it looks very good that in fact there are mass extinctions in the fossil record, that is, in the history of life, that were caused by impacts of things like asteroids, and that they're periodic. They occur about every 26 million years. I think the evidence for that is very good. And so that gives us a picture of the way life developed. It's very different from what you learned in school. You know, it's sort of things become very complex, and all of a sudden this big boulder drops on the Earth, wipes out most of what's here, clears the decks, and then things start again. And for example, You know, if this hadn't happened, we might be dinosaurs instead of human beings.
Really?
Yes.
There was a cartoon in the paper today. It sort of showed the evolutionary chain, and at the end of it were two guys saying, "Hold my place in line while I go and watch TV."
I see. Yeah. Maybe the dinosaurs would have done better. Who knows?
I'm curious. This book is part of a trilogy, Meditations at Sunset. You seem to have explored at least three of the basic elements: water, earth. This new book is air. Do you think there's a book to be written about fire?
Well, yeah, that would be the realm of astronomy. And actually, I have a book coming out on the large scale structure of the universe, which is I guess you could say, since it deals with stars and they're pretty fiery, that would be. That would be in that field.
Yeah, I guess it was. What? Anything you can tell us about the universe? I know there's an article that you've written. It said the Earth is the universe is expanding, but where is it going?
Oh, yeah, that was my list of least favorite questions. Questions I hate to get asked.
Right.
Well, another field of actually one of the most interesting fields in science right now is the study of the very early stages of the Big Bang. You know, we know the universe is expanding now, and we believe that it's expanding now because it started from something like an explosion about 15 billion years ago. We call that the Big Bang. And very close to the Big Bang, temperatures were very high. The matter was in a very strange state, very different from the kind of states we find it in now. And part of the excitement in cosmology and in physics is to go back to that stage and try to trace out the evolution of the universe from the very beginning and perhaps even explain the beginning itself. That's something I think that's within our reach.
Oh, well, I'm looking forward to it. I'm afraid we are out of time. Thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Good pleasure. My guest has been physicist James Trefill. He is the author of Meditations at Sunset, which explains some of the physical world in terms that we all can understand. Meditations at Sunset is published by Charles Scribner's and Sons. He spoke to us from the NPR studios in Chicago. I'm Leanne Hansen, and this is Fresh Air.